This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
They're standing up because they really feel that the European Union has to have a presence in the Sahel region, particularly a security presence, and that security presence doesn't just involve G5 Sahel troops, it also involves training.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, candidates for Cameroon's October 7th presidential election have largely avoided traveling to the English-speaking regions. A dispute over an island raises tensions between Kenya and Uganda, and a commission investigating the killing of three Gambian environmental activists submits its report to President Adama Barrow. We'll have these stories and more all ahead on Africa News Tonight. Candidates for Cameroon's October 7th presidential election have largely avoided traveling to the English-speaking regions, where armed separatists have vowed the vote will not take place. But all of them are proposing solutions to the problems that have crippled the English-speaking regions for 2 years now, leaving at least 300 people dead. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports from Yaoundé.
The only presidential candidate in Cameroon who has visited an English-speaking town is Franklin Difo Afanui, the flag bearer of the Cameroon National Citizenship Movement. Afanui says he mustered the courage to visit Mutengene when his supporters assured him there was calm after the military chased armed separatists from the southwestern town last week. Afanui says he is pleading with fighters to drop their guns.
Let all those who are fighting stop the fighting. The insecurity is coming in because many people are acting out of grievances. Let them not be filled with grievances anymore. We're going to bring in what will satisfy the heart of Cameroonians.
Although the eight other candidates, including incumbent Paul Biya, have not been to the restive regions, they are proposing solutions to the crisis. Main opposition candidate Joshua Osi of the SDF, who is from the English-speaking Southwest region, wants to adopt a federal republic, granting each region greater autonomy.
The problem is not the secession. The problem is the marginalization and the injustice that leads to that secession. Guess what? The secession will not necessarily solve that problem. When you have a president of the republic who understands this issue, the first thing that has to happen is to solve the problem of marginalization.
Candidate Garga Haman Adji of the ADD party is from the French-speaking Far North region. He also thinks it is worth considering a more decentralized government and wants to see more English speakers appointed to ministerial positions.
What is remaining is a joint commission to discuss the Anglophone problem. We are my brothers and sisters. I want this problem to be solved.
The candidates say their security is not assured in the English-speaking regions, where kidnappings, killings, and burning of public property have occurred. President Paul Biya is running to extend his 36 years in power. He says he is ready for dialogue, but opposes any discussions on changing the form of the state. There are doubts the election will be held in Anglophone regions, where 2 years ago, residents began to press for more autonomy, complaining of the dominant use of the French language in the bilingual country. Separatists took over the movement. Last year, they declared a new English-speaking state called Ambazonia had been born in Cameroon. The government responded by declaring war on them. The separatists have vowed on social media that no election will take place and intensified attacks on towns and villages, provoking an exodus of people. The country's elections management body, ELECAM, says it has adopted security measures so the votes can take place. The United Nations says 200,000 Cameroonians have been internally displaced and 40,000 have sought refuge in Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinziga for VOA News, Yaoundé. Cameroon.
Ugandan security forces have stopped an attempt by Kenya to claim it owns an island on Lake Victoria. Magingo Island has been at the center of a territorial dispute between Kenya and Uganda for close to a decade. Ryle Ambor reports from Nairobi.
Magingo Island is just under half a hectare in size, and fishermen from Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania live there because it is surrounded by waters filled with Nile perch. Fishing is a lucrative business and a major economic activity in the lakeside regions of the three Eastern African countries. Reports of harassment of Kenyans by Ugandan authorities in the past week caused Kenyan officials to seek a resolution to the decade-long dispute over which country owns the island. Gideon Ochanda was part of a Kenyan parliamentary delegation that went to Uganda earlier this week on a fact-finding mission after fishermen claimed Ugandan authorities were harassing them.
We confirmed today that initially, we were thinking that there could be more other issues, but we have confirmed today when we are here in Uganda that the problem is with Uganda. We have confirmed that the problem is with the Uganda Army, what we are calling the UPDF, or the Marine, and the Uganda Revenue Authority. Their officers working in the lake have turned to be extortionists. They have turned to be groups exercising torture across people who cannot pay them.
Ugandan security officers evicted Tanzanian fishermen from the island in June. At the end of that month, fishermen protested Uganda's closing of the only Kenyan kindergarten on the island. Last week, residents of the Bukoholi Islands, a constituency in Uganda that is also laying claim to Magingo Island, petitioned Uganda to withdraw its military from the lake, citing harassment and torture of not only Kenyans but also Ugandans who save the lake's waters. The residents presented their petition to Uganda's parliament speaker, Rebecca Kadaga, during an event that was also attended by other Kenyan lawmakers.
Received a memorandum complaining about a number of things. One, that there's interference. The Uganda Marines are crossing into Kenya and beating the Kenyans on the other side. They are also beating the Ugandans on this side. They are also impounding their fish. So the Kenyans, they said they want to move a motion so that the borders of East Africa, in the waters, are demarcated. Can you imagine? We have grown up together, we have been working together because of the harassment which is coming from the Uganda side.
The matter has yet to be discussed in the Ugandan parliament. The fishermen on the lake say demarcation may offer a sustainable solution to their plight. For now, both Uganda and Kenya continue to lay claim to Magingo. Ryle Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
In more news around the continent, human rights organization Amnesty International says from April to July, South Sudan government forces committed a range of atrocities against civilians, even as Juba conducted peace talks with opposition groups. The report says troops shot civilians, burned elderly people and children alive, gang-raped women and hung people from trees. Amnesty staff tell VOA South Sudan in Focus reporter Ayan Bior the goal was to drive people out of opposition-held areas in Unity State. Amnesty researchers spoke to about 100 people who fled the violence. South Sudan's government denies the allegations and calls the report fake. This month, the government and opposition groups signed a new peace agreement to end 5 years of civil war. The European Union Council extended its EU-CAP Sahel-Niger mission yesterday for another 2 years to September 30, 2020. The EU-CAP Niger and EU Civilian Capacity Building Mission provides advice and training to support the Nigerian authorities in strengthening their security capabilities against terrorism and organized crime. The mission has also assisted central and local authorities in developing procedures and techniques to better control and address irregular migration by promoting increased security measures. However, NGOs say the EU's primary focus on security in the Sahel region is not addressing the real issues for migration. Rather, economic development in the region should be their top priority. Reporter Catherine Field spoke with me about the mission and why critics say the mission has been heading in the wrong direction.
They're extending it because they really feel that the European Union has to have a presence in the Sahel region, particularly a security presence, and that security presence doesn't just involve G5 Sahel troops. It also involves training on the ground. So that means in particular with this Sahel-Niger proposal, which has been approved in Brussels, it means that capacity building. It means training local security in Niger to be able to fight terrorism and organized crime. The EU recognizes that they've got to address irregular migration, and the only way they're going to do it is by having their people able to train all of the actors on the ground, and also to be able to, at the same time, make sure that enough is being done from the EU point of view to stop irregular migration.
What are others saying about this program? For instance, NGOs, do they think it's working?
NGOs are saying that this is really just one-sided. They're saying that this is actually just all interest-driven by the European Union. They're saying that it's externalizing EU security, and they're saying that really what it is just a way of, if you like, the securitization of the region. Yes, it will stop migrants. It may well stop some of the traffickers, but it will not deal with the longer term or even the medium term problems such as poverty, eradication, human rights problems, and political dialogue. And they're actually saying to the, not just the EU, but also directing it at France, which is one of the main actors in the area, that they're just doing whatever works for the moment, and just saying that security isn't going to work. So what they're saying is it's a temporary fix, and that the EU, and in particular France, needs to go back to the drawing board and have a look at not just the money it's putting into security, but also the money it's putting into development. And one of the criticisms is, in particular, France spends more than double its budget on security in the Sahel region than it does on development. So they say you really have to look at the entire picture. For its side, the European Union and also France in this region, they say that unless you have security, you cannot have economic development.
Is France working with the leaders in the Sahel region?
France is working very heavily there. They do have a lot of not just the economic and the security, but they have a lot of diplomatic moves there. And if you look, that France is actually at the core of this sort of EU-African Union partnership there. But again, France does look at this region through this security, migration, and then development perspective, and not the other way around, that they are still seeing it as an area where you've got to have security as the main issue there, and then development will come later.
So what is the reason for the big focus on Niger?
Niger is considered to be the backstop for the European Union now. There's just no sign that there will be any significant partnership with Libya. Therefore, the European Union realizes that the security situation needs to be dealt with along that Niger-Libya border. There isn't just this EU-CAP funding that's going into the security. Let's not forget that the European Union is also giving some 1 billion euros in development aid to Niger over the next 5 years. So it's not just the security, but also the development, but a realization that it's not working in Libya. There is no stability in Libya. And so Niger has got to be the next country along in the line that has to be helped to have some sort of security mechanism.
That was reporter Catherine Field speaking with me from Paris. Nineteen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A commission investigating the killing of three Gambian environmental activists has submitted its report to President Adama Barrow. The activists died after a protest over sand mining by the Dulake Engineering Company in Faraba Banta on the west coast of the Gambia. Dulake has been accused of environmental destruction and exploitation, which the company denies. Pandaria Mbai reports from Banjul.
The Faraba Banta Commission report partly blames members of the security forces and other parties to the sand mining dispute for the problems that led to the deaths. Abubakar Tambedu is Gambia's justice minister.
The report highlights a catalogue of errors ranging from lack of consultations among key stakeholders, also mistrust, lack of coordination, but also the report touches on very fundamental issues about the role and responsibilities of government departments.
The full report has not been released to the public. Only summaries have been outlined this week. In June, environmentalists in Faraba Banta clashed with police while protesting at a sand mining operation run by Juloke Engineering Company. The community there says the mining damages the environment and wants it stopped. During the clash, three people were shot dead and others were injured. The commission staff interviewed officials from the Geology Department, Ministry of Lands, the police, the pathologists who examined the bodies of the murdered environmentalists, and executives from Juloke Engineering Company. The commission also looked into the issuance of sand mining licenses. Details of Juloke's mining license will be made public when the president releases the report. Justice Minister Tambedu says the government will enforce the commission's recommendations, including the prosecution of those suspected of breaking the law.
I can assure you that if the report makes recommendations about people who are responsible for a crime, those people will be prosecuted. There's no doubt about it. And these crimes not only include the deaths of civilians, the killings, but also the destruction of property.
Lawyer Emmanuel Diouf is the chairperson of the Faraba Commission. He told journalists that their findings have found some people culpable. Diouf says the Justice Ministry will release the details about those being indicted soon.
His Excellency wanted us to investigate, to find out who may have ordered the shootings and who actually shot the victims, and also to come up with recommendations, key recommendations, so that such things will not happen in Faraba Banta again, but also other parts of the country, but also to recommend ways of improving police crowd control.
Some personnel of the police intervention unit who were linked to the Faraba incident have been charged with murder. Their case is pending in court. Once the president reviews the report, its findings about charges, fines, or citation for responsible individuals will be released. Both the justice minister and the commission's chairman express hope that the findings will prevent similar incidents in the future. For VOA Africa, this is Pandirimbai reporting.
The U.S. State Department has approved the potential sale to Egypt of 56,000 rounds for its fleet of M1A1 tanks. Egypt will use the ammunition against militants linked to the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria in the Sinai. The State Department says the proposed sale will contribute to the foreign policy and national security goals of the United States. This by improving the security of a friendly country and important strategic partner in the Middle East. David DeRoche is an associate professor at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. He spoke to VOA's senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about Egypt's approach to counterterrorism.
In general, a tank is not a good weapon in a counterinsurgency. It's good for establishing control in cities, but only really as more of a psychological presence. The only time a tank would fire its main gun in an insurgency is if you're dealing with a really bad situation, like taking Raqqa back from people who hold it. It's a rather indiscriminate weapon, and it's an inappropriate weapon for use against personnel who basically flit among the civilian population. So I think that the statement that it'd be used for the Sinai is really an American requirement to not get Congress up in arms over this. I think what this really is about is the conventional capability of the Egyptian armed forces, which the Egyptians have been working on for some years, and we've been supporting on them for some years, although it's difficult to see in what context it would be used.
The State Department's justification was that the proposed sale will contribute to the foreign policy and national security of the United States by helping to improve the security of a friendly country that continues to be an important strategic partner in the Middle East. Does that mean the U.S. is approving the military approach to counter terrorism in Egypt?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that we're willing to let the Egyptians do what they feel they have to do, quite frankly, because they don't ask us for permission on this. They're going to do it anyhow. But it is true. Egypt is a key strategic partner of the United States. And Egypt, for many years, has viewed the price of participation in that partnership as the transfer of large number of conventional weapons. There's a little bit of a dichotomy in thinking. The United States views the security assistance we provide to Egypt, and it's almost all conventional. It's tanks, it's fighter jets, it's things that have limited utility in a counterinsurgency. But we view almost all of that as sort of a gift that we give the Egyptians that we can turn on and off at will. I think the Egyptians view it as something they've earned. They view it as almost rent for the Camp David process and for maintaining amicable relations with Israel. So I think the references in the State Department release to the counterinsurgency, I think that reflects more the dynamic of inside Washington, where people are starting to get skeptical and saying, you know, what is this conventional capability that's been built up since the 80s? What is that to be used for? And I think that its application in the Sinai is dubious.
The U.S. released in July a suspended military aid of $195 million, just one day after Congress voiced concern about the ability of Egypt to secure its borders and improve its human rights record. What do you make of that?
I think it should not be underestimated how important Egypt's human rights record is towards relations with Washington. Most of the political prognosticators say that after the midterm elections, the president will be in a weakened position in Washington, in the Senate, and the Senate and the House, which, you know, both have the ability to deny weapons sales. People for years, both in political and military circles, have been asking, what is this Egyptian conventional capacity to be used for? What are these tanks for? Are they going to go into Libya? Are they going to go into Sudan? You know, none of these things seem to make sense. And the United States basically had to let Egypt know that this is not an unconditional transfer of capacity, that Egypt is expected to behave the way that allies of the United States are in terms of human rights, that human rights are important for the United States, not just in the abstract, but also if they want to build the level of trust in government that's needed to effectively deal with the insurgency in Sinai, not just suppress it. You can suppress it militarily, but if they really want to extinguish it and bring the Sinai back into where it belongs as an integral part of the Egyptian polity, there has to be buy-in to the ability of the Egyptian government, and that's not going to be accomplished with tank main gun rounds.
That was David DeRoche of the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. He was speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Solomon Terawali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the African Capacity Building Foundation, the Africa Union's specialized agency for capacity development, has coordinated programs worth $700 million since 1991. The African Capacity Building Foundation, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 17:30 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.